Complications of Modern Democracy was presented by Chris Swanson at Gutenberg College's 2010 Summer Institute, entitled Democracy, a User's Manual. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Here we are again. What I would like to do during this period of time is talk a little bit about the complications and problems that are inherent in a democratic style of government. Most of these ideas I'm taking from a couple of different sources, the primary source being de Tocqueville, Democracy in America. He has a lot of astute thoughts with regard to that. But another place that I looked is a book by Walter Lippmann called Public Opinion, written in the 20s with regard to how opinion is created in a large group, and sort of very briefly added to that some ideas from Jacques Ellul in a variety of books that he's written. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through a series of obstacles or problems or something like that, and the first one is the nature of lawmaking or the legislative process in a democracy. Okay, one of the first things that de Tocqueville notices is that democratic lawmaking process is messy. It's complicated and can even result in contradictory laws. We all know that laws are often the result of compromises in Congress. It's difficult to have a well-crafted, planned-out law that everybody, that people see that this is going to do the thing that we want to do, because there's always some other group that wants to do something different and you end up compromising or changing or something like that. Plans are very difficult to come up with in comparison, say, to somebody who had total power like a king or an aristocracy where they could plan things out, they could agree among themselves, here's what we're going to do. Okay? So that is a problem. The legislators are always changing. You're constantly having people being elected. So you've got a change of personnel going on all the time, making long-term understanding and planning a little bit more difficult. And we are all painfully aware that those legislators are subject to special interests, campaign contributions, lobbyists, and focused voter blocks. I mean, we're just inundated with that information, making it very difficult for legislators to come up with something that they think is in the best interests of the country as a whole, because they have to pay attention to all these various special interest groups. Okay. Another problem with, besides being messy and complicated in the lawmaking process, is that the lawmakers and the constituents tend to be interested in short-term goals rather than long-term goals. So we as a people tend to be interested in whatever is happening right here and now, what we see now, what's going on, what's in the press, what's, and that sort of thing. And so thinking long-term is sort of, we're sort of allergic to it in some sense. So low-level, sustained activity with long-term value is typically not something that comes into the legislative process very easily, especially if there's a downside in short-term. Okay, so a classic example of that would be the Social Security situation. Whatever your position is on the Social Security situation, it seems, from what I've heard, that most people agree that there's a problem coming down the pike here before too long. And the question is how to address that, and that's a long-term problem. It's something that probably would require a lot of thought and care. And how is it going to be worked out? Probably ignored until some group starts losing Social Security benefits, and then there's going to be a lot of screaming, and then there's going to be special interests, and then there's going to be a bunch of compromises. And is that going to be a well-crafted, well-thought-out, long-term solution to the problem? No, it's going to be the typical democratic, messy lawmaking procedure. That's just the way it goes. Okay. If you had, for instance, de Tocqueville would note, if you had an aristocrat who was not subject to the cry and the worry of the people, he would say, those people can think long term because they don't have to worry about stepping on somebody's toes or stepping on that person's toes because their position is fixed. They're not going anywhere. It doesn't matter whether everybody hates them or not. They're staying right where they're at, and they're going to continue to have power, etc. There are some disadvantages to that, of course, but at least that's one advantage that you might have in that situation. Then a third concern about the process of lawmaking is that it is typically unskillfully done. Okay, the legislators are slaves to public opinion, and the public is not necessarily always best informed and wisest when it comes to their own long-term interests or their interests in general. And it's just too complicated. It is way too complicated for the public to really imbibe all the information necessary to make skillful decisions, and also takes, you know, some certain amount of training. And the idea originally in the Constitution was that we are going to elect representatives who are a little bit more skilled, who are having a better background, a better knowledge, a better understanding, and also more time. That's what their life is. Their time is going to be spent trying to figure out what's right and what's a good thing, what's in the interest of the populace, and that sort of thing. And so we are going to give up having to think about those things. We are going to give up that requirement of constantly having to figure out what's going here and what's doing that and taking in all the information. We're going to let the legislators do that. Part of the problem, of course, besides the ones that I said earlier about legislators, is that the legislators that we have typically have excellent skills in getting elected. Okay? That is where their skill set lies, because they have to have skills in getting elected, otherwise they wouldn't get elected. And it is not clear that that particular skill set on getting elected is the same skill set necessary for having clever and skillful lawmaking in the long term. So that, it seems to me, is a bit of a problem. Those skill sets don't have to align with each other. Sometimes maybe they do, but they don't necessarily. So I guess in general, one of the problems with democracy is the process of making laws is not the most efficient, the best kind of process that you might have. Okay. A second problem with democracy would have to do with public opinion. And here I'm gonna sort of step back just briefly and talk about the way Lippmann discusses the psychology of public opinion and how it's formed. The first thing he notes when he's thinking about these things is the nature of symbols. There are some things that we know from direct experience, having lived through them, having seen them, having experienced them. With regard to those things, we do make words, symbols, images to communicate those ideas to each other, but we have that, we can back up and refer to that direct experience that we have of those things. But there are a lot of things, almost all the things that we discuss in the public sphere, that we do not have direct experience of. Nobody has direct experience, at least except for those people that have been over there, of the situation in Afghanistan, for instance. Okay, all that stuff has to come through words and symbols. And because things are so complicated, we have to summarize the events and the activities and the thoughts and the ideas of people into shorter, less complex kinds of phrases and words. And usually we make shortcuts, we make stereotypes, we make summaries and symbols and those sorts of things. So as an example, I mentioned Afghanistan. In order to really understand Afghanistan, I think you'd have to spend your whole life there. An Afghan person understands Afghanistan better than anybody over here will ever understand Afghanistan. In order to understand the United States interest, the national interest in the territory of Afghanistan and the history of our interest in Afghanistan might take quite a bit of study and thought and looking into the situation and a little bit of depth of thinking about those sorts of things. An understanding of the political implications of various decisions that you might make about Afghanistan could probably exercise the minds of analysts for quite some time, trying to figure out what, if I make this decision, it's going to go this way, if I make that decision, it's going to go that way, et cetera, et cetera. That's also a complicated issue that somebody would have to think about. Let's see, where am I? There's also the economic implications, both for us and for Afghanistan. There is, one needs to take into consideration the suffering of the soldiers and the families. One has to take into consideration the impact on the military itself, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so imagine the complexity of trying to make decisions with regard to these issues. And who is it that ultimately is going to be in charge of the direction of the decisions that are being made? It's not necessarily the president. It's not necessarily the Congress, because they are beholden to public opinion. And so how is public opinion going to be informing those decisions? That's going to be made based on media coverage or sound bites or shortcuts or stereotypes or summaries and stuff like that. All those sorts of things are going to take the place of a fuller understanding of the complications of the mess that we are in over there. Okay, so you can kind of see that public opinion is going to be based on shortcuts and stereotypes and things of that sort. Now, anybody who is in the business of public opinion is going to recognize this, and they are going to use those words and images and symbols and that sort of thing in order to create or convey meaning, okay? They're going to recognize that different people are going to listen to these words and symbols in different ways. So what they're trying to do is the same sort of thing that an artist is trying to do when they are trying to paint a picture, or when they are writing a story, or when they are creating a play or something like that. They are using words, and they are using images, and they are using style of their voice, and they are using all these sorts of things in order to create a tapestry or paint a picture for people who are listening to the sorts of things that they are doing. And that skill, I think, Jacques Ellul would call technique. The technique of being able to take those words and in order to convey meaning. And the purpose of the technique is to get people to do something. All right? So getting people to do something, or getting people to pay attention, is what Lippmann is calling enlisting interest. Those people who are skillful in public relations and that sort of thing are constantly trying to enlist the interest of those people in the public so that they can hear and be interested in subject matter and vote the way they want them to vote. So, again, there are techniques for how one enlists interests. Just to sort of give you a flavor for what's going on there, a typical technique would be to create a conflict between a good guy and a bad guy, or to create a conflict between somebody who is suffering and somebody who is oppressing. Okay? As soon as we have a conflict of that sort, you can immediately get people to go and side with the good guy, or the sufferer, or the person who's been displaced, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so if you can create this conflict in public opinion, then you can get people to be outraged at the suffering or the injustice or something like that. Because we immediately feel they're using our natural compassion in some ways to elicit the response that they're trying to get. Another technique is to use words very, very vaguely, and we're all familiar with that. Use a word that doesn't have very specific connotations, or in such a way that different people can hear it different ways, and it can elicit the kind of response that you're wanting to elicit in all the people without getting yourself into trouble. Finally, someone can try and use the words and symbols aimed at a particular group. A lot of times there's so many different interests and so many different kinds of people and so many different particular perspectives that it's impossible to use the techniques to gain the interests of everybody. But you can focus on a particular group and you can enlist their interest, okay, using that particular common interest, whether it be a group of workers or it is a particular religious group or it is a particular political group or whatever. There's some common interest there that you can find. And if you can find that common interest, then you can tap into that interest and use that to bring people to where you want them to go. Okay? And when they do that, they create, in some sense, it's the process of creating factions that we've been talking about. Okay. So, factions. The people who are in these factions, or the people who are the leaders, every faction has some sort of a leader or group of leaders. And these leaders all are going to have, enlist, or be artists in the way that I've been talking about it earlier, people who are expert in the use of words and symbols. So, you know, your public relations people, advertisers for companies, marketers, your television media, your newspaper media, lobbyists, politicians, all these people are people who have been enlisted by various factions in order to accomplish the task that they want to be accomplished. And they usually have a particular goal and they know what their goals and directions are. Those goals and directions are not necessarily what they communicate, but they know exactly what those are, but they don't necessarily communicate them. They are going to communicate those things to the public that they think are going to be most efficient in getting the result that they are looking for. One of the reasons why in the Federalist Papers, for instance, people thought that factions were not going to be as dangerous and as significant was that there were going to be a lot of factions, lots of different interest groups, and they were going to be spread out over a wide-ranging area in the United States. You don't have one faction covering the entire country. And part of the reason for that is because the means and the techniques of communication were not the same then as we have now. It seems to me like that barrier to a faction having a national character has been broken down somewhat by the existence of national media. We can get information. Factions can address everybody. You know, a company can get everybody in the nation on its side using TV, radios, computers, even tweets these days can get people on their side or something like that. Okay. Because the power, ultimate power, it seems to me, resides with the populace, what we have ended up with, where our country has naturally evolved to, is a country where political activity consists primarily of various factions using the tools of symbols and propaganda to vie with each other for votes. So the original democratic ideal, I think, that people had in mind in the Federalist Papers and the founding of the Constitution has sort of given way to this style of democratic process. It is still democratic in a sense that there are still a huge number of different factions, and they are all still vying for interest of the public. But it is a little bit different. It's not the ideal of each of people informed of the situations, voting on things that they know about, and being uninfluenced by the powers that are around them, or being able to have local kinds of control in that sense. Okay, so the next thing having to do with public opinion is the press. Okay, so de Tocqueville actually has a fairly positive view of the press. He recognizes the dangers of the press, but he felt like the press was a really significant and important aspect of any free and democratic government, that it was necessary to be able to have a free press, to be able to talk about injustices or problems that occur, or situations where a majority, for instance, is taking the rights of a minority, where you have smaller groups that have no power. How are they going to get a voice? How are they going to cry for freedom or justice or something? Well, they can obviously cry for justice in the courts, but the courts, the business of the courts is to take injustices that are brought to them and judge them. It is not the business of the court to advertise the injustice to the public and raise public opinion awareness or something of that sort. And that's the business of the press. And he recognized that there were lots of dangers with it, but that it was really important. And I agree to some extent that without a free press, you're really in trouble, because it does work in some sense as a watchdog on the political activity of America. However, according to Lippmann, it's also a bit of a complicating feature. Okay, he says that the news press is subject to the same kinds of psychology that we talked about earlier, that the media is going to create shortcuts, the media is going to create slogans and summaries and that sort of thing. And furthermore, they tend not to report facts, but they tend to use these symbols to express the hopes of the writer. Okay? So they are ultimately becoming kind of a faction in and of themselves. It is a little bit dangerous with regard to the press, or the press can be a little bit dangerous in this sense, that it appears when the press is reporting on something that they have created the perception that they're only reporting on exactly what the facts are. I mean, one of the ways that they do that is they say, look, we've got a TV video of what happened. You saw it with your own eyes. You were there. You know exactly what happened. Okay? But you have to remember that you know exactly what they wanted you to see. Right? It's not that you know everything that happened. You don't know the context for what it is that you saw. You don't know what else was going on. You don't know what the other side of the story is. You don't know a lot of things. You know what they wanted you to see. And those sorts of editing decisions can have a huge impact on what it is that the press is trying to communicate. Also, another concern about the press is that they ultimately are a business as well. And so they're going to be doing stories that are going to be somewhat sensational, that are going to be interesting, that are going to be something that is going to catch everybody's attention and make them excited about, because that will sell more papers, more newspaper, more advertisements on TV, that sort of thing like that. And so they are probably going to be more interested in short-term kinds of things. If there's something that is maybe sort of mildly interesting and has some import for the long term, the press is less likely to cover over a long period of time a story that has some low level of interest. You guys have all seen it. They report on something that happened, and it was so exciting, and then 2 weeks later, everybody's going, now, if anybody remembers, which is very unlikely because the nature of the press is that we move on from one thing to the next. But if anybody does remember, they go, now, how did that thing end up? But the press is probably not likely to report on that because it's not as sensational as the thing that's coming out right now. So it seems to me that the press has the limitation that it is, has its own goals, it has its own biases, and while it can be something that helps us understand or at least expose certain injustices and that sort of thing, it doesn't always necessarily work exactly that way. Another thing that Elul will speak of with regard to the press is that you know, the idea that the press is going to give the populace enough information to be able to decide for themselves what's right and what's wrong and what's actually going on is kind of an illusion. And that we as an American people believe that we are in a position to be able to decide what is exactly going on. But as I said before, things are usually really, really complicated. And although we have some snippets from the press, really being able to have the technological, I mean, a lot of times these questions are so technically complex, and us having the time to devote to them to really know what's going on is very, very difficult. And so even though we have the illusion that we as a populace are in a position to be making those decisions, it's not clear that we do have the information, even through the press, to be able to make all those decisions. Okay, so that was the section on public opinion. I've talked about the nature of lawmaking. I've talked about public opinion and some of the characteristics informing public opinion and the impact that has on things. The next section I'm going to talk about is the characteristics of the population that are desirable in order for democracy to work. Okay? So one of the first characteristics of the population that is desirable for democracy to work is participation. Obviously, if nobody participates in a democracy, you don't really have a democracy, right? I mean, you just have some small minority making some decisions. And so it's really important that the people participate in a democracy. I can imagine, you know, you could imagine a culture where nobody participates, and in which case democracy is probably not a good fit for that culture. Morality, this is the one that I think is so significant and so important, and de Tocqueville talks about it at some length. But if you do not have morality, self-control, and respect for laws and rights, democracy is going to go awry, and it's going to go awry very, very quickly, it seems to me. As soon as you get rid of morality and people are no longer respecting the law, you have to have new laws for every little tiny infraction. You say, you can't do this. But if people don't have respect for the law, if they don't have self-control and morality and stuff like that, there is always a way to get around not doing that. They can do some other technique in order to get basically achieve the same result in some other illegal means, which is maybe legal, but it's not really legal. And then you have to make a law for that one. And then people can figure out some other way of doing something dastardly. So if people are not really interested in morality and self-control and respect for the law and that sort of thing, then you're really in trouble in a democracy. Of course, you're really in trouble everywhere. But probably, eventually, you're going to end up having to move towards some sort of strong authoritarian government just to maintain security if people are going to go in that direction. A third characteristic of your population is understanding of who they are, an understanding of what the government is, what the government does, and what's in their best interest. De Tocqueville talks a lot about an enlightened population. And I think that's what he's talking about. It seems that voters are perfectly capable of voting themselves right into despotism and misery. And that unless people are aware of the dangers of that sort of thing, that is a very possible direction that people can go. So if you don't resist certain natural tendencies that you know, evil people have, then you're going to get in trouble. All right. So those are the characteristics of the population that I wanted to talk about. The next is the tyranny of the majority. This is a problem that de Tocqueville talks about at great length. Okay, he says the majority in a democracy like ours is all-powerful. Well, let's think about that. Who elects the legislature? The people do. Who elects the president? The people do. How do we get judges? Well, the judges are appointed. They're not elected by the people. But for most of the kinds of trials that we have, who's it that sits on the jury? It's the people that do. So there's a sense in which there really is no authority above and beyond the populace. Okay, so there is a sense in which the majority is really in control. I have this beautiful quote from de Tocqueville. He says, "My main complaint against the democratic government as organized in the United States is not its weakness, as many Europeans claim, but rather its irresistible strength. And that what I find most repulsive in America is not the extreme freedom that is there, but the shortage of any guarantee against tyranny." He was really concerned that the majority would take control and do things that are not appropriate. He goes on to say somewhere else, he says, "So what is a majority taken as a collective whole, if not an individual with opinions and quite often interests, in opposition to another individual whom we call a minority? Now, if you admit that an all-powerful man can abuse his power against his opponents, why not admit the same thing for a majority? Have men united together changed their character? Have they become more patient of obstacles by becoming stronger? For my part, I cannot think so, and I shall never grant to several the power to do anything they like, which I refuse to grant to a single one of my fellows." I think that's very astute. We as a majority are no more, by coming together, we are no more moral, we are no better than we are as individuals, and giving all the power to the majority is a dangerous thing in the same way as giving all the power to a particular individual, it seems to me. Another danger of the tyranny of majority that de Tocqueville talks about is the tendency of democracy to claim both body and mind. He contrasts this to, say, a monarchy or aristocracy. In a monarchy or aristocracy, you might have people that are the leaders who are abusive to the populace, okay? But when the leaders are being abusive to the populace, the people are clear in their minds that this is abuse and that this is something terrible and this is something that needs to be resisted and we don't like it. And if the people who are leaders ever lose power, the people are in a position to claim some sort of redress to the injustices that have been perpetrated against them. Okay, in a democracy, okay, the majority seeks to control both the body and the opinions and mind of the people. Okay. It applies social pressure on dissidents or people who disagree, or it ignores them. Okay? So if you go against the majority, there is a certain amount of disagreement. If you disagree with the majority, there's a certain amount of social pressure that says, "Oh, well, really, no, let's argue about that. You really ought to take our perspective." And the majority is continually trying to convince the minority or those people who speak out against a particular majority perspective. And there is a social pressure. I mean, it's very different kind of a social pressure that, say, an aristocracy could place on the people. The aristocracy is not among them. It's not the same kind of interaction that you would have. Okay? He says that if a belief in God erodes, so he's thinking also in terms of the perspective that there is an authority for, say, morals or something like that, or perspectives that is beyond what the majority thinks. And he says that if you get in a situation where people are no longer believing in God, then even things like morality can be decided by the majority. And he says that's a very dangerous situation. An example that I was thinking of was the freedom that families may have on how to raise their children. It seems to me that the freedom that families have on how to raise their children has been slowly encroached upon. The public wants to make sure that children are raised in a certain way, that they have certain ideas, that they have certain beliefs, they have certain socially acceptable kinds of attitudes towards them. And I think this is enforced to some extent in the television. It's enforced in the schools. It's enforced in conversation. It's just part of the culture as a whole to bring everybody in line with sort of the majority view. An example would be, the idea of spanking your child as a disciplinary process has been so completely railed against that it's almost thought of as a crime to spank your child anymore. So it has an impact on disciplinary methods, all kinds of things like that. So that is not the kind of impact that, say, an aristocracy could ever have on the people, the way that the majority has on us here in the United States. And that's part of the democratic process. Another concern of the tyranny of the majority is that whenever a group has power, they continually want to increase that power and consolidate power. And this is seen in all sorts of ways. I think that since the inception of the United States, the power and control, the direct power and control of the populace has grown. There were a number of sort of buffers that were set up and put into the Constitution to sort of separate the sort of the mob rule and the mob mentality or the passions of the people and prevent those things from having a direct impact on the legislation process and the activities of the federal government, and some of those have been removed over time. So I think that the public has, rather than losing power over time, has gained power and probably will continue to go in that direction. Another concern, which is sort of related to the tyranny of the majority, but somewhat different, I didn't know exactly how to put it in here, but I wanted to talk about the equalitarian spirit of the majority and the impact that the equalitarian spirit has on freedom and justice, for instance. I'm all for equality in some sense. If equality is referring to not showing favoritism for one group or one person versus another, I think everybody should be treated equally, and we've been talking about that a lot. The equalitarian spirit that tends to erode freedom and justice is more the equality of conditions. In other words, we have a tendency to want to help and aid those people who are in a lower, income bracket or suffering from some problem or something like that, who have less opportunity or something like that. And there is the idea of aiding those people, perhaps at the expense of those who already have a lot. Okay, I'm not talking about Marxism. I'm just talking about an aid of those sorts of things. And the way that happens is very subtle. We see some injustice. We see some people who are suffering. A small group, whatever that group is, a worker group or whatever. And we feel compassion for that group, and we say, this is unacceptable. And it is really obvious to us, and it is really repulsive to us. Okay? And so we want to take steps. We want to overcome that. And we want to give them more equality. We want to raise them up from their destitute situation. And so we enact some sort of law which will allow them to be more equal or have a better situation in life. What is not seen in those situations, or what doesn't seem so important, is that whose expense is that particular event or that particular law or something? At whose expense is that? It's at maybe at the expense of all the rest of the people, the majority. And these sorts of things, and nobody sort of thinks, you know, so everybody has to pay just a tiny, tiny little bit more. That's just such a small thing that we all have to pay or give up, just this little tiny, tiny freedom that we have. It doesn't seem much to ask from people when then there's this glaring, unjust, seemingly unjust situation, or at least unequal situation that's so glaring and immediate in front of our eyes that we just can't stand to look at that. But this little tiny loss of freedom, this little tiny expense that the majority has to take on is not seen. It's not considered. It's not a problem. And in any particular individual situation, it seems like very, very difficult to not want to help that one group. But the sum total of that process is a very, very subtle and slow eroding of the freedoms of the majority, it seems like, or of other groups at the expense. And our reason for that is because we feel like people should have more equal situations, and we don't like the inequality. It doesn't sit well with us. It seems like our sense of equality can also erode freedom in some sense, or in other ways it can erode freedom and justice. There might be situations where we look at somebody who is doing really, really well, and we feel like that it is somewhat unjust. So examples of that would be there was this period of time where the gas prices were really, really high, over like $4 a gallon or something like that. And the response of the country was to bring the oil companies to Congress to query them about whether or not they were being unjust, because our sense was wrong that we were paying all this money. We were becoming poorer, and the oil companies were making all this money on our backs, and that seemed that there must be something wrong with that. There had to be something wrong with it. There had to be something evil or that they were abusing the system in some ways. And it is interesting to note that that particular event was not that the oil companies were charged with doing something illegal. There was no criminal charges or civil charges that were brought against them. That was a political trial. It was a political trial because the political will of the people felt that there was this inequality that they did not like. And that is the kind of example where our desire for equality can, in some sense, erode the freedom and justice and that sort of thing. I found another quote from de Tocqueville where I think he sort of hits the nail on the head. He says, "I think that democratic nations have a natural taste for freedom, and left to themselves, they seek it out, become attached to it, and view any departure from it with distress." I think that's right. "But they have a burning, insatiable, constant, and invincible passion for equality. They want equality in freedom, and if they cannot have it, they want it in slavery. They will endure poverty, subjection, barbarism, but they will not endure aristocracy." I think he was talking from experience in France there. I mean, people really, really wanted equality. Well, when we're talking about the tyranny of the majority, we would like to think that there is some way to prevent injustices being perpetrated upon minorities or smaller groups by the majority. And I think that when we were talking about the Federalist Papers earlier, those founders of the country recognized that as a problem as well, and they put in certain restraints into the Constitution to prevent the majority from tyrannizing the minority, and they put a large number of obstacles in the way. Okay, the first and most important obstacle I would say that was built into the Constitution is that there is a Constitution. Okay, I mean, in England, and how do you change the Constitution? You have to have a two-thirds majority. It's a very complicated process. It's very difficult to change the Constitution. Built into the Constitution is this document that says, here's the limits of what you can do with your laws. You just can't, you can't overcome these laws. If they're built into the way our society is going to work, and you just aren't supposed to cross those sorts of things. In England, for instance, the Parliament is free to change the constitutional document, if that's what you want to call it, of the land at a majority vote. Not the situation here in the United States. And if the Congress, at the passions of the people or based on some ill-considered popular movement, passes a law which infringes upon those things that we set up in the Constitution in the first place, then there is a method for dealing with that. There's the courts. And you can bring laws up to the courts and say, this law has become is unconstitutional. There are other courts, for instance, that will judge. There's also the courts will also judge if you bring up a law that is contradictory to previous laws. That might happen. You pass a law, and it turns out that that's actually what somebody has passed 50 years earlier in the opposite direction. So the courts then have to decide, you know, how to interpret these sorts of laws. So some complicated messiness there can be sorted out by the courts as well. Another real resistance or restraint on the majority is the fact that there are two houses of the legislature. That was done on purpose. It makes it harder to pass a law. You have to go through the first house and the second house. Another one is that there was a veto of the president. They put that in there on purpose to make it, again, more difficult for the people to do something that was against the long-term interest of the country. There was also the idea that the second house, the Senate, was going to be buffered from popular opinion. And the way that it was going to be buffered originally was that all the senators were, first of all, elected for a longer period of time, 6 years instead of 2 years. And more importantly, those senators were elected by the state legislatures. Ultimately, the people elects the state legislature, who then elects the senator. But those senators were intended to represent the interests of the states, to prevent the federal government from encroaching upon the desires of the states and their free reign and their free execution of what they wanted to do. And that was supposed to be a buffer against the majority. If you had some passion of the majority, and the House of Representatives took it up and said, yes, we believe in you, at least you had this sort of long-term, a little bit more stable, a little less subject to the passions of the people, the Senate, that was supposed to sort of restrict that kind of behavior. With regard to the president, a similar situation was put in place. The idea was that you would have an electoral college. The people would vote for a representative for you. You would, in a small group, you would vote for a representative. I think the idea was that the representative was somebody that you knew and were aware of, and you were electing them because you knew that they had the wherewithal to go up to Congress, and then everybody, all the electors, could have a debate as to what was the best decision for who should be president. Okay? It doesn't really work that way, but I think that was sort of the idea originally. Another, and perhaps the next two are the most important restraints on the government and the tyranny of the majority. And these are not in the structure of our government. And those are religious belief and traditions and customs. Okay, as long as people maintain certain religious beliefs and a certain moral standing in the country, it is unthinkable for us as a country to pass a law which would be in violation of our sense of absolute justice or our sense of absolute wrong and right. It is conceivable, in the absence of such, that there is no reason why the majority couldn't pass a law which was horribly demeaning or ruination of some small group of people, if there was no sense of justice for us to say, no, that's not right. Okay, I can imagine that would happen. But as long as people have a belief in an absolute justice, then that is a huge restraint on the tyranny of the majority. And then obviously also traditions and customs come in. We as a people have traditionally respected the rights of individuals, and we have respected the freedoms of individuals, and those traditions are still really, really strong in our country, I would say. And they provide a really significant restraint on the kinds of things that the government does and can do. I would say that since the founding of our country, many of these restraints have been lessened. They have been eroded to some extent. We now elect our senators, for instance, directly, not through the state legislature. The Electoral College is all but defunct. I mean, when you put on the ballot who you're electing, you know who you're electing. You're electing a particular presidential candidate, right? And the only reason you pick that particular elector is because they have already said ahead of time that I'm going to vote for this particular candidate. That happened right away. And there have been other ways that I think also one could argue that the Supreme Court, which is supposed to act as a restraint on the passing of laws which are against the Constitution, has become subject a little bit more towards majority opinion, in that if the judges are of the opinion that the entire nation has moved in this particular direction, then they feel a certain freedom of allowing certain laws to be judged either constitutional or unconstitutional in accordance with the general feel of the country. It sort of has become a little bit more politicized over the last, I don't know, 70, 80, 90 years of its existence than it was originally. The restraint that de Tocqueville talks about probably the most, well, maybe not the most, but one that really struck me was his idea of local administration. Okay? His idea was that the federal government really was not in charge of the day-to-day local operation of the various areas of the country. That communities could decide to do what they wanted to do. They could pass laws. They should have the freedom to do what they wanted to do in their locality without having the federal government being in charge of every little thing that they did. And when he was looking around, as I said before, he saw that was, in fact, the case in the United States. In 1831, when de Tocqueville was writing, nearly all administration of the government activity was done by local governments and groups. There was no IRS. There was no Department of the Education. There was no Department of Health and Human Services. There was no Department of Energy, et cetera, et cetera. So all of these federal bureaucracies and associations have been built since then. And people took responsibility. And he noted that they were extremely energetic and extremely involved in the political process because they saw what needed to be done, and they were invested in having it done, and they saw the consequences of what they were doing, and it was an immediate thing for them. So people were extremely energetic at that time. These days we have a little bit more of a centralized administration, it seems to me. The federal government addresses the safety of products, drugs, foods, etc. That it addresses poverty, it addresses social problems, taxes, education, local projects in the form of pork, natural disasters, parks and public works, business practices, you name it. I mean, the government has got its hand on the administration of a lot of things that are associated in our lives. Now, it seems to me that having the federal government be involved in those many kinds of administrations of our activities has certain complications associated with it, certain problems and complications associated with it. Number one, the more areas that the government controls, the more it wants to take them. Okay, the government can do that. It does it so subtly and so easily by the use of money and the giving out of money. I know particularly that that's the case in, for instance, education. Once the government starts handing out money to educational institutions, then the government feels like it has a right to expect a certain return for the money that they have given. And so slowly but surely, there is more involvement by the government. And the more they have, the more they want to take. Furthermore, the more the government becomes in charge, the more we as a populace learn to expect and want the government to be in charge. If there is a problem in our country today, what do? Fix it! Fix it! You know, and if you don't fix it right, you didn't fix it fast enough, you didn't do it right, or why didn't you do it right, or we've got to get rid of you and get somebody else in there that's going to do it right. It's not that we don't want you to fix it. It's we want the right person to fix it. And we as a public demand and expect that all these problems are going to be solved by the government. This, it seems to me, is a sign of tyranny of the majority. An example of that, I hope I don't get myself into trouble, but if you have health care which becomes publicly controlled and is under the purview of government, then something like obesity becomes a national issue now. It's not a personal issue now. And the reason for that is because if people are overweight, it presumably costs more to the federal government. And so now we're going to have government programs that are going to be associated with that sort of thing to deal with that as a social problem, okay, which was not really a social problem. It was a personal issue. So it seems to me that the government, once we start down that road, it sort of insinuates itself in our lives in a lot of different ways and continues to do that. Another concern that I have is that it seems to me that the government addresses a lot of the issues that it takes charge of rather inefficiently. Part of the reason for that is that it is so completely separated from the problems themselves. The problems are individual problems, group problems, and these individual problems may be different for this individual than it is for that individual, or they may be different for this locale than they are for that locale. But in order for the government to deal with them, they have to make laws and regulations that are sort of broadly applicable. And so they are very, very far removed. In fact, they're removed not just in terms of knowledge of the situation, but they're removed by the existence of a bureaucracy that has been set up. And the bureaucracy itself may have multiple levels. And so even if the lawmaker, for instance, wants to pass a law, it's not always the case that the bureaucracy is going to take it in the direction that the lawmaker wanted to. Another problem is that it's very difficult for the government to know for sure whether or not the programs that it puts in place are really working. How are they going to know if the programs are going to work? Who's going to know if the program is working? Suppose you set up some social program or something like that. Who's going to best know whether that program is working? Probably the worker who is working with the people directly. Okay? They're going to know better whether that program is working. How are they going to communicate that to the lawmaker at the top as to whether that's going to work? And what is the incentive for that local worker to make things work right, for instance? They may feel like it's not working.
It's working,
Yeah. That's another issue, is that the worker there may be incentivized by security of the job, the increase in the budget of their particular bureaucracy. The bureaucracy in and of itself takes over, has a life of its own, a separate existence, and they have a decision-making power that in some senses is greater even than the decision-making power of the lawmakers themselves. And so there is this buffer between the will of the people through the lawmakers, through the bureaucracy, down to the effects that are happening in the populace themselves and the solutions that they're trying to solve, those sorts of things. And it's very difficult to pull something like that off, it seems to me. Okay. So, in conclusion, I still think democracy has a lot going for it, but it has a lot of problems, and there are dangers. And de Tocqueville and Lippmann have indicated some of those things. There are lots of illusions that we as a country hold about democracy, about the success of democracy, and I think that it would be worthwhile to be aware of them. I know that there's been this quote that's been bouncing around, everybody's been quoting. So I went up and looked it up on the internet last night, and I found it was from Winston Churchill. He says, "Many forms of government have been tried and will be tried in this world of sin and woe. No one pretends that democracy is perfect or all-wise. Indeed, it has been said that democracy is the worst form of government, except all those other forms that have been tried from time to time." For solutions to the problems of democracy, I refer you to David tomorrow. That's it.